Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but I just don't work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to start off with looking at chamomile tea and how it can reduce risk of death in older Latino women. University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston on that. We're also going to look at how a Chinese herbal mixture significantly reduces fatigue in cancer patients and how Tylenol in pregnancy can lower testosterone in unborn boys. Not a good thing. And why getting by on little to no sleep spells trouble for cells and organs, plus a lot more. Then we're going to look at chemtrails, the consequences of toxic metals and chemical aerosols on human health, a special report from Dr. Sandra Pellangeri from Global Research. Also, how much would you guess that physicians are paid by pharmaceutical companies to hawk their drugs and medical devices? Well, according to Charles Ornstein of ProPublica, it's huge. Doctors earn $3.5 billion in kickbacks from pharmaceutical companies. So the government's data on payments to doctors and hospitals by drug and device makers is more than what anything considered reasonable. That means that it doesn't make it a safe drug or a good drug. It means it's profitable to the physician. Who knew that there were 200,000 trips that are paid for by pharmaceutical companies for doctors? And these are not riding on a Greyhound bus or a flying coach. So we'll deal with that. Then extending that concept, how medical journals are an extension of the marketing arm of pharmaceutical companies. And this is from Richard Smith from PLOS Medicine. This is a major medical journal saying this. So when you hear someone say, well, it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, good. Was that an independent peer-reviewed journal or one that had a lot of advertising from Big Pharma? Because if it was Big Pharma sponsored, the likelihood is it's just propaganda. So we'll get into that. And then I was watching a debate, and I thought it was just pathetic, concerning our current social crisis on many different levels, but we seem to pay only attention to that which bleeds. So, if there is a demonstration, if there is a wrongful death, it galvanizes our attention. But we do not put it into a larger historical context. So today we're going to hear a debate in England from a group of individuals, mainly African-American, or I should say African, who want to have us look at slavery and how it impacts us today. And then I'll give a different perspective on why we should look at that old concept of 40 acres and a mule. And by the way, 40 acres and a mule was very successful if you were white. How much would we actually owe African-Americans today if we look back and really were honest about slavery, how slavery made America powerful and wealthy and racist? We'll deal with that on today's program. Let's begin. Now, when I first got into the health field, the only health drink that was promoted was chamomile tea. And fine, you know, the little golden chamomile flowers, many of us have grown them. But there's a whole lot more to than that. In the major journal, Gerontologist, they took a look through a study at Texas Medical Branch in Galveston, University of Texas, and they saw that it actually decreased the risk of death from all causes, from everything, in Mexican-American women. Now, we know the chamomile is one of the oldest, most widely used, and well-documented medicinal plants in the world. And it's been recommended for a variety of healing applications, not just as kind of a mild calmative. And in this case, they took a look at 1,677 women and men with Hispanic backgrounds, and they then saw the impact of chamomile, and it was associated with a 29% decreased risk of death from all causes among women compared to those women who did not use chamomile tea. Quote from the study, "The reason for a difference in our reported findings between Hispanic women and men is not clear, although women were shown to be more frequent users of chamomile than men. This difference may be due to traditional gender roles, whereby women manage the day-to-day activities of the household, including the family's health, and also that they are more likely to rely upon folk remedies such as herbs." So what we know is that there's something in chamomile. We've known that it helps with hyperglycemia, upset stomach, diabetic complications, anxiety disorders, lowers cholesterol, is a great antioxidant, is an antimicrobial because women historically have used it as a natural douche, and it's an anti-inflammatory, and it's an antiplatelet. People who have had strokes will use chamomile to thin their blood. So this is just the latest. Also, for people who have cancer, there's a good study from Peking University as well as the University of Texas, and it talks about the fatigue, the severe fatigue of persons with cancer. Now, I've worked with so many people with cancer, and the first thing you notice is that they have no energy. They're listless. Their mitochondria are not functioning properly. Well, in this study, what they found is that with just within 2 to 3 weeks of treatment with the traditional Chinese herbal mixture, it is called Ren, R-E-N, Shen, S-H-E-N, Yangron, Y-A-N-G-R-O-N-G, Tang, T-A-N-G. But it's also found by the initials R-S-Y-R-T. Again, R-S-Y-R-T. It's a soup, and in that soup are 12 herbs. And it has been tested in clinical phase trials 1 and 2, safe. And this was published in the Journal of Alternative Complementary Medicine, a peer-reviewed publication, and found that it works. It makes a big difference, helps people overcome fatigue, gives them lots of energy, especially those suffering from fatigue and cancer. University of Edinburgh, a study showing that if the pregnant woman uses Tylenol during her pregnancy, it will adversely affect the testosterone. It will reduce the testosterone production in unborn baby boys. And that's not good. So don't use Tylenol. If you have problems, there are other natural ingredients to use instead of that. And that was published in the Science Translational Medicine. We are a very stressed society, and because we're stressed, we don't get the sleep that we require. Also, a lot of people work late hours. Not good. Working night shifts could knock 8 to 10 years off your lifespan. But in addition to that, if that weren't bad enough, then we frequently go to bed with televisions on in the background or radios or cell phones by our head. Not good at all. So here's the latest on this. We know we should be getting a good night's sleep, but the reality is people are not, and it leads to a lot of problems. In fact, drowsy driving has been found to be responsible for 1,500 fatalities and 40,000 non-fatal injuries every year in the United States. And in fact, the CDC finds it so important, it considers lack of shut-eye a public health epidemic. Now, there's a new study that shows sleep deprivation is linked to cell and organ damage. The study, conducted by scientists at the Medical College of Wisconsin, established a link between increased disease risk and sleep deprivation, specifically noting that the cells most damaged, including the lung, the small intestine, and the liver. Quote, "This study culminates years of work and provides physical evidence that sleep deprivation injures cells and that sleep recovery restores the balance between other parameters, DNA damage and repair. That is from the professor of neurology, cell biology, and neurobiology anatomy at the university. So get your full night sleep. And this was published in the peer review journal Sleep. And finally, green tea, red wine, can reduce cough and cold risk. This is from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. What they did is they found a study done at the university that when people eat flavonoids found in green tea, apples, blueberries, coca, red wine, and onions, that can significantly reduce the risk of catching colds and coughs. In fact, the study showed adults could be 33% more protected against the common cold or upper respiratory tract infections if they eat flavonoids or take flavonoid supplements compared to those who don't. Now, people who eat flavonoids also took fewer sick days off, and that's important. Quote, these findings show that you're generally healthy. Eating flavonoids found in lots of fruits and vegetables can help stave off the viruses over winter. And most adults average 3 colds or flu per year. So this can help all that. Now, if you just have yourself a good salad and you had sweet onions in there, that contains sulfur. That is a protective agent. Garlic is a protective agent. Watercress has protective agents. And, of course, your berries, especially the blueberries, are extremely beneficial. So get those and protect yourself. And, oh, one last thing. This is from Umeå University in Sweden. Parkinson's disease is more likely in people with depression, quote from the study. People with depression may be more likely to develop the movement disorder Parkinson's disease. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. According to the authors of the study, depression is more common in people with Parkinson's disease than those without the movement disorder. Quote, we saw this link between depression and Parkinson's disease over a time span of 20 years. So depression may be a very early symptom of Parkinson's disease or a risk factor for the disease. And this was done at the university in Sweden. One more reason to de-stress, detoxify, relax yourself, and find healthier ways of coping. I mentioned already on a program earlier that exercise really helps you as you age. Tel Aviv Medical Center shows that running or jogging or power walking is great to escape Alzheimer's disease. And exercise slows down aging of the brain and can reduce risks of Alzheimer's and other dementias by 50%, which means then if you have Alzheimer's or dementia, you should engage in regular activity. That would be very important. And I also mentioned the other day that orange juice was very good for you, but now there's a study out of Reading University that, quote, drinking orange juice could help improve brain function substantially. And I believe that's because of the antioxidants in the orange juice. And blueberries increase immunity and reduce blood pressure. Well, the very first things that I counsel someone who has high blood pressure, start looking at starting your day with a berry smoothie. Blueberries, blackberries, raspberries, and strawberries. You put those in along, and if you have pomegranates, that's good too. You put that in, and then you put some vitamin C and a liquid, whatever liquid you like, and that helps lower blood pressure. That's the latest on the health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back and get into some interesting discussion about how our doctors could be influenced by the drug companies paying them directly. But we're never told this. We should be. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
Behind. The reason I know
like to welcome all of you. Nice to have you with us today. Let me just give you a little preview of who we have lined up over the next 6 days to share insights. We have Joan Halifax Roshi going to be with Professor Richard Davidson talking about what is required in mental development to have an economics basis on altruism and empathy. Then we have Dr. Robert Scheer on advances in oxygen therapy, especially for Lyme's disease. And Chris Hedges returns to discuss the moral imperative behind revolt. And Nick Terse, our war historian and journalist, on how Africa is being destabilized and prepared as the Pentagon's new battlefield. And Professor Henry Giroux on the violence of organized forgetting, how the politicized social control disengages us, in effect, allows obedience, conformity, and forgetfulness. And James Tracy, Professor James Tracy, is going to talk about psychological benefits of rewilding our consciousness closer to nature. Those are just some of the topics that we'll be covering over the next 6 days. Also, our running and walking club is meeting this Sunday at 9 o'clock in 90th Street in Fifth Avenue in Central Park. It's free. It's a public service. And whether you just want to get yourself into better shape or run the marathon or walk the marathon, show up, ready to start your training. We have 17 coaches who are going to be there to help you out. Now, tomorrow at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'll be lecturing live in Orlando, and it's full, thousands of people, and then they're expecting 15,000 people, I believe I was told this morning, are signed up, and it's free. And since everyone else can't be there, I'll give you the information of how you can, it'll be on my website, how you can watch it if you want to. That'll be fun. Also, good news for those of you who would like to get some free health counseling to help you with the issues in your life. Dr. Nadia is back. She has just completed 2 years of doing her certification work to become board certified. Remember, she's the one who graduated top of her class at Albert Einstein School of Medicine and Yeshiva University. And she's great with helping people. And she also speaks Arabic and other languages. So if you'd like some free counseling, and we're happy to have her for as long as she's able before she goes into her own full-time practice, give her a call, 646-771-3081. 646-771-3081. We already have several people who are really good and experienced and qualified in their fields, and still we have more people than what we have that we can help. There's just so many people need help, but I'm glad to see that she called and said she's willing to come in for the time she has over the next several months and help out. We appreciate that because she was a great help before. Now, this is from Dr. Elizabeth Lee Vlatt, medical doctor. Quote, "Chaos and disruptions in medical care have had one tragic and destructive effect that no one is addressing, the deaths of more than 2,000 physicians by suicide since Obamacare was passed by means of strong-arming and bribery. Physicians in general have a higher rate of suicide than other professional groups and the general public. Women physicians' suicide rates are reported to be up 400% higher than women in other professions. Why are more physicians seeing suicide as their only option? The rising rate since 2010's Affordable Care Act was passed points to the added regulatory and financial pressures from Obamacare as major factors. Need to see more patients per hour to make ends meet, lower payments, longer delays in being paid, and declining patient visits due to higher copays and deductibles. Financial stress, a known trigger for suicide, intensified by 50% decline in practice revenues as overhead costs go up, forcing many primary care physicians to close up their practices, but still have debt. Increasing administrative and paperwork burden, which takes time away from patients. More generalized one-size-fits-all protocols demanded by insurance and government guidelines, more forms and reports and regulations that no one understands, but with huge financial penalties and even prison time for making mistakes. Demonization of greedy doctors by insurance companies and government media. Well, doctors also have been at higher risk of suicide than other professions for other reasons, like pressures of responsibility for patients' lives, fear of making mistakes that might cost a life or trigger a malpractice suit, fear of losing one's medical license and livelihood, long hours, time away from families on nights and weekends, higher rates of unrecognized or untreated depression and alcohol and substance abuse, and divorce. Doctors are human, too, and have feelings. I think other critically overlooked factors in the rising suicide rate include the increased sense that doctors are just a cog in a wheel, interchangeable with those having less training and experience, feeling unappreciated by patients who toss them aside like an old toy when insurance plans change, frustration with patients who dismiss medical recommendations if it is not covered by my insurance, loss of autonomy and control and independence as faceless insurance clerks and bean counters and license boards and government agencies dictate how, where, and when medicine is to be practiced with no knowledge of the patient in question. Physicians are also their own worst doctors and feel they can handle their own health issues and stress. There's the ever-present social stigma about seeking mental health treatment, but for physicians, this is magnified by the fear of being penalized and having their medical license jeopardized if they seek treatment for depression or stress. We encourage others to seek mental health professionals if appropriate, but most physicians are afraid to do this themselves because such treatment must be reported on each medical license renewal application, increasing the risk of losing one's license and livelihood. Physicians also fear losing hospital privileges if treatment for depression is disclosed. Hospital administrators increasingly use mandated psychiatric treatment as a bullying tactic to remove independent-thinking, patient-focused physicians from hospital staffs. All of these problems, especially the feeling of loss of control and loss of autonomy in one's medical decision-making, have escalated dramatically with the ever-increasing regulatory burden under Obamacare. A death by suicide is devastating to families, leaving emotional scars that may never heal. So, that's from one doctor, and I felt it's important. And I would agree with many of those things because I have a lot of personal friends who are physicians. In fact, when I lectured last to a group of about 4,000 physicians in Chicago as a keynote speaker on a study I'd completed, afterwards, there was a room of about, 200 or 300 who had gathered for an informal discussion. And a woman came up to me, an MD, PhD from San Francisco, and she showed me a reimbursement check. It was for $1. And she said, I spent over 12 hours, all told, helping a patient, but I was using natural, non-toxic methods, getting the patient well, and this is how much the insurance reimbursed me. So for 12 hours of my time, I was paid $1. And so I asked the room, I said, have any of the other of you received $1 for treating a patient? Every hand went up. I had no knowledge of that. I didn't know that. That's why some doctors are now opting out, not having any insurance, and a lot of doctors are looking at other professions. Yes, we hear about the high-paid specialist, but what about the internists, the general practitioners? They're the ones who are feeling this burden. Now, this then leads to another area. Now, you have over 930,000 physicians, but this is from Charles Orenstein of ProPublica. Quote, the federal government unveiled yesterday details of 4.4 million payments made to doctors and teaching hospitals by pharmaceutical medical device companies. The launch of the so-called Open Payments website, mandated under a provision of the Affordable Care Act, was far from glitch-free. Some users encountered long delays and sometimes error messages trying to access its 7 data tables. But once you started to look at the information, you started to realize, gee whiz, look at all the money doctors are given. The total? $3.5 billion, with a B, billion dollars, to 546,000 individual physicians and 1,360 teaching hospitals. And so that's just wrong. And then you start looking, and I have a list of where all the money went, and it's just huge. So, you know, you look at a pharmaceutical company that gives out money for using a drug, and I've mentioned this many times on the air, how will that then impact how a doctor uses a drug or if they would use that drug? And then all the more to be appreciated are those physicians who say no to the drug detail people, do their own homework, and then decide how they want to treat a patient. There was also, quote, doctors were paid for more than 200,000 trips by companies in the last 5 months of the year. And they generally are paid to go to Dallas, Chicago, New York, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. Why? Because that's where the pharmaceutical companies do their workshops, and doctors are paid. Wow. So something new that we didn't know. So I believe that we should take all medicine and make it one medical system, and that is that it's public medicine with all alternative healing allowed without being challenged based upon a lack of good science. There are thousands upon thousands of studies showing that prevention with good diet, exercise, stress management will help prevent the very diseases that we then are overwhelmed with today. So why aren't we teaching this to doctors in medical school? Why isn't this a part of every single doctor's practice? Why don't we have people in doctors' offices teaching lifestyle and behavior modification, which we should? But doctors don't control medicine today. It's controlled by pharmaceutical companies. It's controlled by the AMA. It's controlled by major businesses. And then here's the latest on this. And by the way, if we had universal health care, then no doctor would go bankrupt. No patient would go bankrupt. There wouldn't be any co-pays. And we wouldn't have doctors being bribed in order to use a drug. We wouldn't have that. This is from PLOS Medicine, one of the most respected medical journals in the world. Quote, medical journals are an extension of the marketing arm of pharmaceutical companies. Quote, journals have devolved into information laundering operations for the pharmaceutical industry. Who was that? Richard Horton, editor of The Lancet. In the same year, Dr. Marcia Angell, former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, lambasted the industry for becoming, quote, primarily a marketing machine and co-opting every situation that might stand in its way, end quote. Well, medical journals were absent from her list of co-opted institutions, but she and Horton are not the only editors who have become increasingly queasy about the power and influence of the industry. Jerry Cassier, another former editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, argues that the industry, meaning the pharmaceutical industry, has deflected the moral compasses of many physicians, and the editors of PLOS Medicine have declared that they will not become, quote, part of the cycle of dependency between journals and pharmaceutical industry. Now, it's not just advertising. What's more important than the advertising, which influences journals, is doctors believe every single study that comes out that is promoted in a journal. First, many of the people in peer review are paid. They have been bought off. Secondly, you never hear about the bad studies. If let's say that you were trying to show that your cancer drug was better, but you did 100 studies, 99, it showed it was worth, but one study, you managed to manipulate the statistics and show it was better. You will never hear about the 99 failures. You'll only hear about the one success, and they control every aspect of it. But then you won't even know who did the actual study because they'll pay a ghostwriter, a famous medical doctor at one of the big Ivy League schools, to put their name on, as an author on the study, even though they knew nothing about the study. It had nothing to do with the study. It was all planned and committed and worked out by the pharmaceutical company. So the peer review system does not solve the problem. It is bad science. It is manipulated science. So the pharmaceutical companies are the ones who should be held accountable. They're the ones who are absolutely destroying medicine as we know it. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to listen now to a discussion. And I believe that we need more of these discussions. By the way, just to show you how bad it's getting, not just in medicine, but in our entire society, of which medicine is but one part. This is from Princeton University. This is from Brandon James. Quote, a new study from Princeton spells bad news for American democracy, namely, it no longer exists. Asking, quote, who really rules? Researchers Martin Gillens and Benjamin Page argue that over the past 20 years, America's political system has slowly transformed from a democracy into an oligarchy where wealthy elites wield most power. Using data drawn from 1,800 different policy initiatives from 1981-2002, the two concluded that rich, well-connected individuals on the political scene now steer the direction of the country, regardless or even against the will of the majority of voters. Quote, the central point that emerges from our research is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on the U.S. government policy, while mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. So, what we the people want and need and should have is irrelevant. It's those who are in power. So look at the big banks, the ones who are found criminally negligent and engaged in nonstop criminal activity. They are the ones that we pay attention to, but not the independent people who have the public interest in mind. Now we're going to go to a debate that I think we should have in the United States that will give us a different perspective on the role of history, and especially history when it comes to slavery and how we can get different perspectives on it. You'll hear different people discussing this in this particular debate. Let's go now to that debate in England.
Morning, Ursula. Well, let's ask you first, because what's really fascinating about this and what a lot of people have not really focused on are the ongoing effects. I mean, there is something that you've spoken about before, intergenerational transmission of trauma. Tell me about that.
Yes, well, basically, slavery and genocide has impacted not only the historical populations that were kidnapped from Africa, but also those of us who are the descendants of the enslaved today. And it's not only about trauma and multi-generational oppression. The whole discussion around wealth, there has been unjust enrichment to Britain, and there's also been unjust impoverishment, which has been passed on throughout the generations. So part of the legacy is this huge inequality that we see today between the descendants of the enslavers and the descendants of the enslaved.
And what about and psychological scars which have had societal effects, ongoing economic effects to which
definitely.
You've already said? What are the psychological scars?
Well, part of that...
Intergenerationally.
Intergenerationally, it's not knowing who we are. It's a lack of connection, it's a lack of identity, a lack of nationhood, which is what makes us human beings, essentially. It's not being rooted, it's being considered minority populations when we come from global majorities, and it's about having second-class status and citizenship wherever we have been located as a result of this dispersal and depopulation that happened originally in Africa.
And there is a phenomenon as well that you believe is really does exist, which is post-traumatic slave syndrome.
Yes, well, it's something that I've not coined, but many of our social theorists and psychologists and psychiatrists have been looking at some of the negative legacies that we have internalized, the internalization of racism, self-hate, anti-African sentiments and prejudice and discrimination, a loathing of ourselves, vacancy.
Self-loathing
in terms of not being proud of who we are, not being proud of our heritage, not being proud of our African ancestry, changing our looks to kind of emulate Caucasian beauty ideals. These are some of the real legacies today in terms of the psychology. We also have to look at the rates of mental health illness. And this has also been linked to that.
All roots back to slavery.
All roots back to that.
Can I ask you as well, Fern, as you're there, I mean, you don't know each other, but it's wonderful you're both on the programme today, how has it affected you, Fern, slavery? You now, a woman in 2014.
Well, it's very important what Esther's been saying about post-traumatic slave syndrome and the trauma that that's caused down the ages. And it has affected me because I've needed people to help me to get to where I am today. And I think if they hadn't done that, I wouldn't be talking to you today.
So you've been lucky in that?
I've been very lucky in that I've been helped to be where I am today by people who are aware of the problems that Esther has raised.
And as a successful academic, that's something you've had to battle against what happened
back then. I've
had to
battle against racism in particular.
But as a result of slavery?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Daniel Hannan, one of the things, of course, which is most egregious about this, many argue, is the fact that the slavers at the time of abolition, in 1838, I think, were paid enormous amounts of money, huge amount paid to the slave owners, equivalent of at least £16.5 billion today. So why shouldn't the people who are still suffering have reparations?
Because I'm descended from slaves, and you are descended from slaves, and everybody here is, and everybody watching at home is. Slavery was universal. We're all also, by the way, descended from slave owners. Human history being what it is, it could hardly be otherwise. Slavery was practiced in China, in India, in Arabia, in Africa, by the Aztecs, by the Mayans, by the Incas, by the Pacific Islanders. Muslims enslaved Christians, Christians enslaved Muslims. And therefore, if you're looking at paying reparations, anyone whom you choose to pay is statistically certain to be descended both from the owners and the owned. There were 3,000 black slave owners in the US on the eve of the Civil War. We are, if you like, all in this together. And it's therefore very difficult now to look at a population. I'm not talking about continuing slavery, which is a huge issue and where we could be doing a great deal. But if you're looking at past slavery, it's just a question of how far back you want to go, and we're all slaves.
No, we're not all descendants of, enslaved peoples and enslavers. I think that is really, falsifying history, and it actually is minimising the seriousness of what we're actually talking about. Chattel enslavement, as happened to African peoples and people of African descent, is something different and unparalleled in human history. And that's the starting point for this conversation. It's very cheap to then say, well, we've all been enslaved, because right now I don't have the same life chances and life experiences of many people who might even be sitting in this audience. I feel we need to understand this history. I'm not saying that we haven't all been impacted, but just to say, well, we've all been impacted the same is really not the starting point.
Yeah, and Bernadette. And I'm sure if anyone wants to make a point...
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, so get the tomatoes out and start throwing them now. Look.
Has it affected you?
Okay, no, and this is it. I think we really have to be careful here. Has all that got to do with slavery, being in a mental institution? I am a champion, a volunteer. I'm a motivational speaker that visits prisons twice a week. Now, some of the lads in there, their crimes are not for because I was a slave 150 years ago. I think at some point, yes, of course, we all know slavery was there. My God, bad things happen. Bad things happened to me once, but it's what I do. You don't walk around with it. You have to move on. We've got to rise above it now and start moving on and thinking, okay, what are we going to do in the next 150 years so that our children can see, this happened to my great-great-grandfather, but wow, look what they've done now. We've got to start rising above this and get away from you owe me this, you owe me that, and going back. Look, of course, every black person knows it's really difficult in certain areas.
What about the people who have profited from it? You know, the families that are still enriched.
Again,
because of
we
this.
Know this.
The tobacco millionaires.
So I live in Dorset. What am I going to do? Knock on all the manor houses in Dorset and say, right, give me a room for the night, mate. You know, hello, where does it end? You know. Yes, they know. They are. Some of them are named and shamed, Nikki. They're all in Google. You can see who they are. They have been named and shamed. Almost an apology was made by Tony Blair. Yes, an apology. But the trouble is, no British government is going to apologise because that would open the floodgates.
Fern, come on. Audience, please hands it, Fern.
Almost an apology. Apology was not made by Tony Blair.
He expressed regret. Yeah.
Well, that's not an apology.
But there's a reason why. We know. I'm a realistic person. Let's be honest. It'll be another 150 years before they actually apologise and hand out cheques. And how are they going
to
do it?
Well, we're not asking for cheques to be handed out. It's not about money. That cheapens the debate.
Yes,
it's
I know.
It's not about money.
But, But if they apologise, you do realise the implications of if you apologise.
The legal implications. Well,
yeah, for legal implications. Then the compensation, where my great-great-great-great-great-great-father, he was... How are we going to do it, you see? How are we going to do it?
That's not what CARICOM are asking for. CARICOM are asking for the first time ever, that the Western nations that were involved, such as the UK, France, Portugal and so on, sit around the table with 15 heads of government and talk about the issues that plague us now.
And then what?
And what the issues that plague us now, what has that got to do with slavery? Because, I mean, my dad was 85, God bless him, when he died last year. That never stopped him. He's a millionaire. He worked hard.
We need education. It's very important. One of the things that CARICOM talk about is education.
But what has that got to do with slavery 150 years ago? Education, my dad educated me. The five girls, we got educated. Not one of us, touch, would have gone wrong. I think all five of us has done well. I don't understand.
The point to recognise here is that we're not talking about something that happened 150 years ago. Mm. We're talking about the current impact of slavery, colonialism and neo-colonialism, which brings us right here into the here and now. That's right. What we're talking about.
In the order, okay. I know you want to come back on that. hands up in the audience, please. Let's get some quick points. Yes, you've had your hand up for quite some time. Good morning.
Sorry, in of discussing whether African Caribbean countries should get reparation, it's saying that we've all been slaved before. Then why can't you? One question to that is, why can't you correct it and show that it's not right by doing that? Also, the money that does go back can go into development schemes. And it is absolutely insane to assume that slavery hasn't got an impact. It's also like saying, oh, I've made it, so why can't you? You could look at victims of domestic violence and say, okay, you've made it in life, why haven't you? The trauma on those children and those children, people could...
Do you believe in the intergenerational transmission of trauma?
I do.
What happened to your forefathers? Yeah.
100%. Yeah. And also because if you're in an environment where there was self-hate, the problem is, you brainwashed Caribbeans, Africans, etc., and told them, you know, you're slaves, you're slaves, you're slaves. You didn't unbrainwash them. You didn't take it out of them. It has to be us building ourselves in order to remove that mindset. And society also has to open its mind. But you need schemes. You need things in place. We need economic power as
well. Okay, let's address that in a minute. Anyone else who wants to just make a quick point? Over here. There's someone. I'm sure there is some more hands up. Yeah, gentlemen at the back, quick one.
I think the economic legacy now, you're talking about Jamaica, which is spending more money repaying debt repayments than they are spending on education and health.
Exactly.
So how are the Caribbean countries going to move out from there when they're expected to do that? Yeah. Talking about the freedom for countries.
And that cancellation of debt is one of the CARICOM demands, isn't it?
That's one of the things they're arguing for.
And that would have a massive impact, would it?
It would do, but what we actually recognise, it goes beyond debt cancellation, because the debts are illegitimate debts. It's debt repudiation. The people of the Caribbean didn't owe anything. And the reason why these debts were imposed on them is in itself a legacy of colonialism that must be corrected.
Daniel Hannan.
Well, I just wanted to come back to Esther's point that Britain was different. That, okay, we're all descended from slaves. The Greeks did it, the Romans did it, but the UK...
The Muslim slave trade, of course.
The Muslim slave trade.
15 million people were enslaved. Yeah.
Between 11 and 17 million Africans traded by Muslims. But let's just focus on what makes Britain different. What makes Britain different is that we extirpated this disgusting business. We were pouring energy, not into just the abolition in our own territory, but in wiping out the slave trade. Even when we were in a life and death struggle against Napoleon, we were diverting ships and men to stamp out the transatlantic trade, from which we derived no diplomatic gain, no profit, because it was the right thing to do. So if Britain is different, it's different in a very good way.
It's not. Actually, we talk about abolition, but we don't talk about Britain's commencement into this whole process of enslavement.
That's because we didn't commence it.
1562.
That's because we didn't commence it. It had been happening forever.
1562. All the wealth that was generated that helped to make Britain great, so-called, the British Empire, all of this came from enslavement and colonialism and ill-gotten gains. And it links to this modern discussion around inequality and the huge gap between the nations, not only in terms of Britain and Europe, but also the rest of the world, and in particular, Africa and the Caribbean.
There was existing slavery going on in Africa, which had been going on forever, as it had been going on in Europe.
It was not the same.
What made us different
is that
we stopped.
That is a falsification of history. What we had in Africa was systems of pawnship and forms of serfdom,
so
which
was very
similar.
Different.
You're listening to Esther Stanford in a BBC-sponsored debate on this subject. I want to offer a few insights, and then we're going to another discussion at the Oxford Debate Society. Let us go back for a moment, because I'd like to address something that two of the people mentioned there. It was slavery that made America wealthy. It was a racist principle upon which white American became wealthy because they were not paying for the labor of the blacks. And that's something we should not forget. If we added up how much that long period of slavery, which, by the way, was 246 years of legal slavery, that extracted wealth that the blacks contributed through their labor to the white population. Now, you had close to 4 million African Americans enslaved. That was 13% of the American population. And it was a gross injustice, but slavery launched modern capitalism. It turned us into one of the wealthiest countries in the world. If you don't have to pay for the labor in a manufactured product, you save a lot of money. Cotton built New York City into a commercial and financial empire. New York's share of all cotton revenue was 40%. You also have to look at total cotton production. U.S. cotton used in British textile industry was 77%. And you have to look at the slavery worth. It was worth minimum of $3 billion at the outbreak of the Civil War. You have to look at the Emancipation Proclamation. Let us be realistic. The Emancipation Proclamation did not benefit the slaves. In fact, there was 40 acres and a mule that was given so you could go and own land and farm it, but there was none of that given to slaves. In fact, President Andrew Johnson overturned General Sherman's promise, which would have redistributed roughly 400,000 acres to newly freed blacks. And on April 16, 1882, President Abraham Lincoln signed the bill ending slavery in the District Attorney, but there was the money that went in the United States, in the Caribbean, in Haiti. It went to the slave owners. So it did not go to blacks. Do you realize how much money they would have given to the slaves? But they gave all that money to the slave owners. And vagrancy laws allowed police to arrest black men and then rent them out as convict labor. That's correct. In 1865, it was 13% of black convicts in the United States, or in Nashville, Tennessee's main prison. These were not people who had broken any law, except they were vagrants. So if you were poor, you were put into slave labor. And how much is it when you look later? It was 64% in 1869. And there was zero loans given to blacks. And you had to actually pay $100 for a business license fee, but whites had to pay nothing. So it was costly to get into business. And it kept African Americans out of receiving help. Other citizens received housing. They would receive education. They would have received. And Southern merchants used unfair credit to impose blacks from building wealth. So that's what is not taken into account. If you take all this into account, today African Americans would be owed about $6 trillion. Now, to close out our program today, we won't hear it all, but let us begin by hearing what one man in a debate that very few people have ever heard at the Oxford Center in 1963 had to say.
Mr. O'Connor.
What is your real name?
Malcolm. Malcolm X.
Is that your legal name?
As far as I'm concerned, it's my legal name.
Have you been to court to establish the
story? I didn't have to go to court to be called Murphy or Jones or Smith. Excuse me for answering you this way.
That's all right.
If a Chinese person were to say his name was Patrick Murphy, you would look at him like he's insane, because Murphy is an Irish name, a European name, or the name that has a Caucasian or a white background. And a yellow person, Chinese is a yellow man, and he has nothing to do or no connection whatsoever with the name Murphy. And if it doesn't look proper for a person who is yellow or Chinese to be walking around named Murphy or Jones or Johnson or Bunch or Powell, I think it would be just as improper for a black person or the so-called Negro in this country, as we're taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, to walk around with these names. And therefore, he teaches us that during slavery, the same slave master who owned us put his last name on us to denote that we were his property. So that when you see a Negro today who's named Johnson, if you go back in his history, you'll find that he was once his grandfather or one of his forefathers was owned by a white man who was named Johnson. His name is Bunch. His grandfather was owned by a white man that was named Bunch.
Would you mind telling me what your father's last name was?
My father didn't know his last name. My father got his last name from his grandfather, and his grandfather got it from his grandfather, who got it from the slave master. The real names of our people were destroyed during slavery.
Was there any line, any point in the genealogy of your family when you did have to use the last name, and if so, what was it?
The last name of my forefathers was taken from them when they were brought to America and made slaves. And then the name of the slave master was given, which we refuse. We reject that name today.
You won't even tell me what your father's supposed last name was or gifted last name was?
I never acknowledge it whatsoever.
And that was, of course, Malcolm X. We will bring you the extended version of Malcolm X's debate at the Oxford Society discussing racism, discussing the impact of slavery upon an African American. But until such time that we as a society are willing to look at what we did to millions of people for hundreds of years and how we built our industrial society, we built our sprawling suburbs, we built our infrastructures on the backs of these individuals and then excluded them from proper education, with rare exception for their own schools like Tuskegee University. And how even today, what we should do is ask all of those major corporations that were built on slave labor then to set aside a certain percentage, a reasonable and small percentage, to go back into the African-American community to build schools, infrastructures, plants, low or zero interest loans to start up businesses and to give opportunity. Because without jobs and opportunity and education and without the yoke of constant fear of the white community that somehow because a person is black or a teenager or wears a hoodie or lives in a deprived area that somehow they are a threat to society, then we're going to have them shot in the back, we're going to have them tasered, we're going to have a prison system filled with them, and we're not going to resolve any of this. We have de-evolved at the spiritual and emotional level when it comes to treating people with the dignity and respect they deserve. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
Cowboys girl, I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up, bang bang, baby. I remember when I chased the girls and beat 'em up. I'm
Yeah.